With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And joining us right now on the Harbor One Hotline, it is the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker. Hey, governor.
How are you, Greg?
How you doing?
I'm fine. You know, I used to have 10 or 12 events a day, and I used to talk to, shake hands with, and hug hundreds and sometimes thousands of people in the course of my day. And now I'm either at home, or I'm in the state house, or I'm in the car going between home and the state house.
Yeah.
And it is... it's amazing to me that a month ago, everything was completely different.
On a personal note, can you ever prepare for something like this? I know at one point you said to me that this had been like unlike anything you'd ever experienced in your professional career. I mean, is there any way that you I'm sure you don't anticipate it. Is there any way to prepare for something like this?
You know, I think the look, hindsight's always going to be 20/20 on this stuff, right? But I certainly have said several times that one of the lessons I hope we learn from this is that while a global economy is a good thing, and you know, certain countries in a global economy can prove themselves to be very good at certain things, and other countries can be proven to be good at other things. And that's okay if everybody, you know, sort of works together. But I certainly hope one of the lessons we learn from this is that when it comes to sort of critical public health supplies and initiatives, especially when it comes to the potential for future viral outbreaks of one type or another, because we have a global economy, that all of our supply chains don't start in other countries. Because
yeah.
I do believe that the American manufacturing community is and the healthcare community is picking up the ball and running as fast as they can with it. But we've been playing catch up since the beginning, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I mean, to be getting all this stuff elsewhere and to not have it here or, is an issue. I would agree wholeheartedly with that. You, on that note, you announced yesterday that we are getting another 100 ventilators from the federal stockpile.
By the way, literally just before I got on the phone with you, I got a communication from FEMA that we're getting another 200 that will probably be arriving sometime in the next couple of days. So that's 400, and we continue to pursue some private market opportunities, which I am hoping, you know, you never say yes until this stuff shows up, that we can deliver some additional ones that way by next week. But we'll obviously continue to press the feds for the 1,000 machines that we talked to them about, you know, 4 or 5 days, 6, 7 days ago.
I know you were really frustrated last week. We could all see that when it came to trying to get this stuff. How would you describe the way it has been working with the White House on this?
I get the fact that, well, take my opening comment to you about the fact that a lot of the supply chains for a lot of this stuff don't start or haven't started historically in the U.S., you know, which creates shortages on many fronts. And there are many states that are struggling with that issue. And we're just one among among the many. I do, and I have said before that I was extremely upset about having those 3 million masks that we bought through BJ's wholesalers impounded in the Port of New York. And that was when I started calling everybody I knew to try to find a path to get some N95 masks for healthcare workers and emergency workers and first responders here in Massachusetts. And, you know, the good news on that one is, with a lot of hard work by a lot of people and the support of the Kraft family, we managed to get 1 million N95 masks into Massachusetts. And then we also worked with our colleagues at Mass Hospital Association and at Partners Healthcare to get that Battelle machine, which does not sound very sexy, but it is a giant decontamination device for N95 masks so that people across the Commonwealth will be able to use those masks multiple times, which obviously stretches the useful life of those masks and means that if you have 1 million and you can use them 5 or 10 times, that means you really have 5 to 10 million. And there are only 4 or 5 of these Battelle machines up and operating in the U.S. And it's a real tribute to a lot of work that people did here to get that machine here, to make it part of our sort of arsenal of tools to keep people protected and to make sure they have gear as we head into the surge here.
Governor, when the masks were confiscated in New York, I know a lot of people were kind of curious about that. Was that a customs issue or a security issue? What agency stepped in there? Can you give us any information on that?
Anything I would say would be speculation.
Gotcha.
So, okay.
Fair enough.
I'm not going to speculate about that.
Okay.
There were 140,000 unemployment claims filed here last week, and you've been very responsive when it comes to trying to get those who need it access to unemployment. But I know you know this. It's been difficult for some to get that. What is the state doing to make that process smoother and to get checks out quicker to people?
So this is a great example of what happens when you just shut everything down at once. In a typical week in February, even the first week of March, Massachusetts would get about 7,000 to 10,000 new unemployment claims. 7,000 to 10,000. In the last 3 weeks of March, we got 500,000. So the 3 weeks before the shutdown started, we got somewhere between 20,000 and 30,000 unemployment claims. And in the 3 weeks after the shutdown started, we got almost 500,000. And at the same time that was going on, we were also moving a lot of our own workers into remote locations to create social distancing for all the same reasons everybody else was. So we used to have a 50-person call center at the Hurley Building in Boston. Now we have a 600-person call center working remotely, which started, obviously, as a 50-person call center working remotely, and then we just added people over the course of the past several weeks. I can say that 250,000 people in Massachusetts this week who use direct deposit for unemployment are getting their unemployment checks plus the $600 supplemental payment that was part of the CARES Act. And our remote call center has called 60,000 people so far. They're making 6,000 or 7,000 calls a day to people whose applications are in the queue to do what they need to do to get them processed. And I know this is an incredibly frustrating process for everybody, believe me. But those folks are working 7 days a week, as hard as we and they possibly can to try to push, you know, a level of volume that no one has ever seen ever through a system that was not built to absorb that much traffic in such a short period of time. The one thing I will say is that there are many other states where the systems have just crashed because they just couldn't handle it at all. And people are literally standing in line to fill out paper forms, which is a tragedy in some respects. The one thing we did do a couple years ago was we moved the platform and the data for the platform onto the cloud so that it could expand. We didn't know it was going to have to expand quite like it's had to expand in the past 3 weeks. But we're going to do everything we can to get the folks who are filing their benefits. And as we get guidance from the feds for the folks who aren't in the unemployment insurance system, right? You know, the people who don't work for an employer, who don't get a W-2,
independent contractors system. Like this.
Exactly. Yeah. The gig economy, self-employed. They don't exist, right? In the UI system, there's no data there about what they make, and no way to validate what they make other than to sort of bounce whatever information we have on them up against tax records and determine, you know, if in fact this is the same person and this is what they make. Because remember, you know, unemployment, even for these folks, right, we're going to have to figure out what they made and validate it and then pay them, you know, 50% of what they made up to a certain amount, because that's the way UI works, plus the $600. So we're literally going to have to build an entirely new database that we've never had before to process information on those folks to make sure that we're pinging, that we're, you know, when they file, that we ping that against something that demonstrates that they are who they say they are and that they made what they say they made, so that we are accurate in what we send to them. I support the policy of creating a program for this group of people. But since they're not in the current unemployment system anywhere, unfortunately, it's going to take a little while, and I hope it doesn't take a long while, but it's going to take a little while just to create the technology infrastructure to validate who they are, validate what they made, and make sure we pay them the right amount. And as I said, I support the policy. I advocated for it. I believe it's the right thing to do. It's just going to take a little while to make sure we stand something up that actually works. And the feds, remember, this is also Fed money, and they're going to audit and make sure that we did it right and that we could validate that we paid people the right amounts based on information about who they were, where they lived, and what they made. So we just got to make sure we get that stuff right. And that's on top of processing the 500,000 people into a system that typically takes 20 or 30,000 people every 3 weeks. So, look, it's a handful. We all know it.
People
are working hard to get it done, and we know how important it is to people that we get it done. But I can tell you the 250,000 of those folks are going to get their UI, their regular UI check, plus the $600 this week on direct deposit.
The White House appears to be discussing May 1st as a as a potential back to work, back to business day. Would you be following their guidance on that, or would you be on your own on that? And where are you as you think about that?
So there's a guy named Scott Gottlieb who, for your listening audience, was at one point the federal Food and Drug Administration director under the Trump administration. Very smart, very talented guy. He left about maybe a year ago, maybe a little less. No, it was less than a year ago. He wrote a paper about reopening the economy, which was published by the American Enterprise Institute about a week ago. I would suggest if you really want a roadmap for how reopening the economy works, I would or could work. I would suggest that people Google Scott Gottlieb and read Gottlieb and read it's a 20 page paper. It's not long, but and read that paper. But he basically says you know, you can't just flick the switch and reopen the economy as long as the virus is still present, unless you're willing to do some things to deal with the presence of the virus, because otherwise it'll just start. The whole reason we're doing all this incredibly painful and difficult, but incredibly important and purposeful social distancing and shutdown is because we're trying to stop the spread of this incredibly contagious virus. And, you know, Scott basically lays out that you got to have a big time testing program in place. And you have to do a lot more surveillance, which we talked about doing. We're the first state in the country that's actually talked about creating with Partners in Health, which has done this kind of work in third world countries and developing countries where they've had contagion outbreaks of one virus or another, doing this tracing, contact tracing, where, you know, once somebody's deemed positive, you chase everybody in their network and test them and require them to isolate. And that has turned out to be in South Korea a big part of how they've been able to gradually reopen their economy. But you got to be doing something to stay on top of this thing in a very aggressive way that continues to isolate, to treat and isolate the people who get infected, or you just end up right back in the same soup that we've been in since the beginning of March.
Now, Governor, you had talked about May 4th then. So what does that mean? Because it almost sounds like then you potentially could be pushing May 4th back another couple of weeks. Or what are we going to be hearing from you on May 4th as far as reopening? I know the kids going potentially
Wiggy back, wants his kids yep. back in school. Back to That's school. What Wiggy wants. He wants the kids out of the house and back in school.
But getting all that information, it sounds like you're saying no, that...
That's a legit question. And what I would say is that we will probably make a determination on that certainly before May 4th. Okay. And we've been talking to Secretary Pizer at Education and to the Commissioner of the Department of Education, Jeff Riley, as well as with many of our partners at the local level about the rest of the school year. And I, you know, my big concern about all of the stuff associated with the rest of the school year is the unevenness of the way kids and families and educators are dealing with this in the meantime. I mean, there are some shining examples of schools out there that have, you know, been teaching their kids every single day. And their kids have homework and the kids have access to the internet. And while it's certainly more complicated, for the most part, when you talk to those families and you talk to the educators in those schools, they think they've done a pretty good job of keeping the kids engaged and continuing to further their education. But that's, you know, there's just no question. That's not universally what's happening around the Commonwealth. And I worry a lot that there are many kids who are simply missing a good part of the second half of their academic year. And as we all know, there's a ton of literature out there that says that, you know, when kids fall behind, if you don't recognize and appreciate that they fell behind and create, you know, acceleration programs and after school tutorials, and, you know, if you don't do other things right to help them catch up, the likelihood that they will just catch up on their own is just not there. So one of the things we've been talking with the folks at the Department of Education about is how do we gauge who actually managed to continue to pursue their academics over the course of the second half of this year and who didn't, and then how do we make sure that we create programming for those who need to catch up so that they can, because the last thing you want to do, whether you open the schools between now and the end of the year or not, is end up having a whole bunch of kids, like literally tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of kids come back to school next fall and, you know, literally be half a year behind where they need to be without having done any of the work to figure out how to help them catch up.
Well, when it comes to the economy, some economists suggest that we may have an unemployment rate of 25% by June here in Massachusetts. If you can't find a way to reopen things in a reasonable period of time, are you not concerned about that kind of that depression-like scenario for this state?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this, both on the public health side and on the economic side, is this is like the first time, right? So it's not like there's a playbook you can look at that says the last time, the last five times this happened, the last three times, the last 10 times on either the fighting the virus on the public health side or, you know, dealing with some of these sort of forced economic shutdowns on the business side. We don't have there's not like a history on this that you can look at and figure out what it's going to look like coming out the other end, because there isn't a there. You're learning from other people's experiences and doing the best you can to sort of predict the future. But what I would say is that, what Scott Gottlieb and those folks wrote was sort of a path forward for how you could think about creating the preconditions you would need to put in place to start opening the economy again. And with respect to the unemployment rate, Greg, you know, there's a lot of wide variation in the way people at this point are predicting where they think the economy is going to be 3 or 4 or 5 months from now, mm-hmm. which makes perfect sense because there's so many unknowns in there and people just have to, you know, put their thumb on the scale wherever they think it makes sense to put their thumb and then make a prediction or a set of predictions based on that. But what I will say is a big part of getting, you know, a big precondition in the report that Scott wrote is you got to do a lot more testing and you got to do a lot of work around who's contagious, who's infected, who they've been around, and come up with strategies for treatment and isolation there. And they got to move fast, which is why we basically set up this partnership with Partners in Health where, you know, they're going to hire probably 1,000 people to start with to do this contact tracing with us. And it may be that we end up hiring more. They had 10,000 applications from people who wanted to do this. But if you don't have a big, robust program in place to both test, identify people who are infected, and then come up with a program to deal with that, it's going to be hard for me to understand how you can actually sort of open the doors up and get back to what most people would call sort of normal. The other thing I would say is there's a lot of progress being made on what are called antibody tests. And this is something that, you got to be careful what you read and what you believe. But the basic idea behind antibody testing is it's pretty much instantaneous. It's usually a finger prick of some kind and a quick run of your blood. And if you have antibodies to fight coronavirus or COVID-19, then what it basically tells you is that you had it and you now have antibodies, which makes you, for some period of time, and that's something the scientists are trying to figure out, immune. And that becomes a really important fact in terms of trying to figure out exactly where we are with this. And the fact that it's a quick test and it can happen, you know, you can do it for a lot of people. It's another part of what we're starting to see people do in some of the countries that are a little farther ahead of us in terms of their own battle with this virus. And I certainly expect you're going to see a lot more of that kind of testing going on in the U.S. and in Massachusetts.
So do you foresee that we would, when it comes to large groups of people, you know, like sporting events, that we would be able to get those in this summer?
I think a lot of it depends on the, you know, read Scott's paper. A lot of it depends on where we are, on our ability to test and identify risk. And in this particular case, risk represents people who are infected. Because remember, you know, somewhere around 20% of the people, at least so far, who are infected with this virus don't show symptoms. So you got to figure out some way to test on a broad enough basis that you have a belief that you can do a pretty good job of figuring out who's infected and therefore contagious and who's not. You got to be able to test. And like I said at the beginning of the call, the testing industry, the healthcare industry, has been moving, you know, very aggressively to catch up on that supply chain, because a lot of the elements of that supply chain have historically come from other parts of the world, and people are now building capacity to deliver those parts of the supply chain here. And I think in many ways, that's one of the biggest elements of sort of creating the muscle mass, for lack of a better word, or the infrastructure domestically to be able to do the kind of testing on the scale that we would need to do it to be able to better identify exactly where we are. I mean, one of the biggest issues with testing, and this isn't just true in the U.S., it's true in many other countries, is the availability of the test kit, right? But what everybody should know about that test kit is it's made up of what, for all intents and purposes, are swabs. And, you know, they're sort of super steroid versions of the swabs you've seen before in your doctor's office. And they require a certain amount of reagent to actually make the test work. And swabs, for the most part, are manufactured other places. And as we create those test kit capabilities, and as we generate, you know, the millions and millions of swabs that we need to run through our testing machines and our labs, we will be far better prepared to be able to sort of really understand where we are and what we can do and how we can move forward. But that means creating a supply chain that starts in America, so that we can make all we need and not have to rely on, you know, global competition from the five places on the planet that actually make some of this stuff, which has been a huge part of the frustration and the difficulty that I and many other governors in many other, you know, countries, frankly, have been dealing with in terms of just arming ourselves to fight this thing.
A week ago, Governor, you welcomed the Patriots jet back from China, loaded with millions of masks. How did that partnership begin? Who originated the call? You obviously were very frustrated with the inability of being helped with getting masks before that. How did that craft partnership come to fruition?
So after we had the incident at the Port of New York, I literally just started calling people that I knew in Massachusetts who had, like, global relationships. And one of the great things about Massachusetts, we have a lot of global citizens. We have a lot of people here in industry and business and healthcare and life sciences and arts and culture and academia and research who have giant global networks, right? And I just called them until what I was looking for was somebody who could actually help me purchase N95 masks somewhere else. And eventually I came across some folks who said that they could help me purchase a significant amount of N95 masks in China. And then the question became, well, how do we actually get them back to the U.S.? And we basically concluded that doing something with, you know, sort of traditional commercial transport, either by boat or by plane, would be risky, and that we really needed to sort of come up with a big private plane. Now, there's lots of small private planes, but if you want to get a big cargo, you need a big private plane. And as I thought about that, I remembered that the Patriots had a big private plane. So I called Jonathan Kraft and I said, I think I have five masks, which we really need. And And I asked the crafts if they would be willing to sort of spearhead the process of working with us to get the plane into out of the U.S. into China and back. And eventually it became like a humanitarian mission. And the way the flight path was basically Boston to Alaska, where, you know, people sort of slept and refreshed themselves. And then from Alaska to Shenzhen and China, the airport there. And then 3 hours on the ground, nobody got off the plane. Nobody came into the plane. The only part of the plane that was open was the cargo holds. And the gear was put by a Chinese company into the cargo hold. We had a 3 hour window that they permitted the plane to be on the ground. And, you know, they were on the ground for 2 hours and 57 minutes. And then they flew back to Alaska and flew from Alaska the next day back to Boston. And it was, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to that thing. And a lot of people in both the U.S. And in China were very helpful in making it happen. But it was, and we really needed it. And you combine that, as I said earlier, with that Battelle machine, which can decontaminate N95 masks. And we have the potential, you know, we have a lot, we need more, and we continue to chase them from a variety of places. But I feel much better about where we are on being able to protect our frontline workers than I did, you know, 10 days ago.
Governor Baker is our guest. When you look at certain sectors of the economy here in Massachusetts that have really been devastated, whether it's, you know, barbers, hairstylists, gym owners, certainly restaurants and bars, if we're not able to get them open soon, do you foresee any kind of special aid for them or something? Because, I mean, there's people who are losing everything.
So the I know. I talked to a lot of them. Remember, the feds are sending everybody who made less than $75,000 what, for all intents and purposes, is a one-time grant, which at some point will be coming to families here in Massachusetts and around the country. They also put up a very significant small business loan program. And I can tell you that while, you know, the start on that was a bit bumpy, you know, we talked to the banks pretty much every day in Massachusetts about how much lending they're doing against that SBA program. And I'm pretty sure that they've put almost $2 billion in those low interest, very generous repayment policies in place for businesses in the Commonwealth of Mass already. And I'm sure that they will be doing more of that based on what I've heard coming out of Washington. In fact, there's a big debate going on down there right now about doing more for that. And again, the unemployment insurance, we're going to get out the door as fast as we can. We just redistributed about $800 million in state and federal funds to our healthcare community so that they can continue to weather the storm as they go through the process they're going through here. And I've talked to a lot of banks and landlords about what their policies are and how they plan to treat their customers over the course of the short term, defined sort of as 30 to 90 days. And many people are making a lot of accommodations, but I totally get the fact that when you shut things down as fast as things got shut down here and elsewhere, not just in the U.S., but around the world, it's a calamity for a lot of people, but I don't know how else we could deal with the nature of this virus other than to do something that just separated people from one another to the fullest extent possible. And with respect to the you know, the restaurant folks, we've done the best we can to make it possible for them to do takeout. We got the legislature. We worked with the legislature, and they were good enough to give them the ability to include sealed bottles as part of the takeout that they make available to their customers. My wife and I have done a lot of takeout to support restaurants. I know many other people have done the same thing. But it's a, you know, we're in a really rough circumstance that where we had to make some big choices, and they were literally sort of life and death choices. And no one disputes, and I said this many times in my press availabilities, no one disputes the fact that the economic hardship associated with this is profound.
Now, Governor, you
totally get that.
Now, you talked about testing, right? And I think one of the things that I think a lot of people want to know, and Iceland is probably, they said, the ahead of the world and everything, because they tested almost 10% of their population. Now, granted, it's a lot smaller, but they did it by random testing and selecting people based on the country's, you know, main directory. How are people, you know, going to be able to get tested? I know there's a facilities in Lowell that just opened up. But I think a lot of people want to know how people are going to get tested, if it's going to be something random, or do you have to be showing symptoms? I mean, what when you're talking about testing, what is it going to be like for people that are in Massachusetts that want to know, how can I get a test?
So most of the testing that's going on at this point is defined by circumstances, right? So there are six or seven categories from the CDC. And if you have any one of those six or seven categories, then you're supposed to get tested, right? And the categories have to do with symptoms and stuff like that. But in Massachusetts, we also test first responders if they've come in close contact with people who are COVID-19 positive. We do that at a number of sites, and we also test. People, both workers and residents at senior care facilities, if they have people who have tested positive. We have a mobile unit that's a series of mobile units that are basically run by the National Guard that have visited, I think at this point, 120 to 140. Long-term care and senior care facilities in Massachusetts to do on-site testing at places where people have tested positive. And I think over time, where we're going to end up is, you know, and I'm going to go back now to this issue I talked about earlier with respect to swabs, and then I got to go, guys.
Yep.
The FDA recently approved these desktop devices that normally are used to do influenza and pneumonia testing, okay? And there are 19,000 of them in doctor's offices, outpatient clinics, and hospital offices around Massachusetts. The only thing that's stopping them from swabbing and testing practically everybody who comes through the door is the availability of swabs, right? This test kit on the front end and the reagents associated with that. I do believe what's ultimately going to happen, to answer your question, or this is certainly one way of thinking about what happens, is you'll have both these antibody tests, which I do believe will get better and will become far more prevalent, to test people to determine if they've had the virus and developed the antibodies to deal with it. And I could see that ending up at some point in the not too distant future becoming part of sort of a regular checkup when you go to the doctor. And I do think we'll start swabbing at some point many people when they go to the doctor, the same way they, you know, take your height and weight and do the other stuff. But part of that's about building the infrastructure, the capacity to do testing on that kind of a scale is sort of a routine thing that's just part of the way our public health and healthcare system works. But in the meantime, folks, in the meantime, you know, we're about to go through a very difficult period. All the modeling we've done and the modeling others have done suggests the next few weeks around Massachusetts are going to be particularly difficult ones as we go through the surge that other parts of the world have already gone through. And I want to impress upon your listeners, you know, how important it's going to be as we head through this, that they stay at home if they can, that they only go out if they need to. If they're going to go to some place where they can't socially distance, like the pharmacy or the grocery store or something like that, they should wear a face covering. You know, if you don't have a mask, pull up a turtleneck or, you know, wear a bandana or a scarf. Take this seriously. And I know the weather is probably going to get nicer and people are going to want to start thinking about all the things they do when the weather gets nice. They need to recognize and understand that to protect themselves and to protect others, people need to continue to socially distance. Part of the reason why South Korea has been successful in coming back is because they are very disciplined about hygiene, distancing, and face coverings. And they test like crazy, and they contract trace. Now, we're gonna amp up our testing, and we are going to contact trace. But you need everybody else to engage in these issues around distancing and face coverings when you can't distance and hygiene. You just got to do it, and you got to make it part of the way you just think about how you go about your day. It's got to be part of everybody's routine. It needs to be routine. And I got to go, guys. I got some other stuff I got to do.
We will let you get back to work.
The time. I certainly appreciate the time, and I will say that I also appreciate the fact that when I do have a chance to tune in, I continue to enjoy the fact that there is something out there going on somewhere in the world other than this, and it's nice to have a chance to tune in and listen to people talk about things like football and baseball and basketball and, you know, life generally. And you guys are a welcome, especially for somebody like me who spends almost their whole day thinking about and talking about and dealing with this thing, to have a chance to tune in and hear a conversation about something else that I used to care a lot about and hope I will again at some point in the future.
We just need to know if it's Curtis or Ken who gets under your skin sometimes with their comments.
How about E, all of the above?
All right, Governor, thanks for taking the time with us.
See you guys.
Morning. All right.
Take care.
There he is, Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts on the Harbor One Hotline. We'll have a chance. Everybody wants to weigh in on what he said, which is that it's going to be a long time till we can.
That's what it seems like.
Till we can open back up.
Correct.
I know we're up against the clock. Ken is. So, Ken, good thing. I don't think it's you. I think it's you and Curtis.
Exactly.
All right. We'll be back to discuss next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.